Please turn with me in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 41. Genesis 41, as we continue to take a look at this dramatic narrative of the life of Joseph. You'll remember that where we ended up last time was that Joseph is in prison for a crime that he did not commit, falsely accused by Potiphar's wife. And so as we come to chapter 41, that is the setting and the context. Joseph is in the pit of prison. We'll read this chapter in its entirety. After 2 whole years, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile, and behold, there came up out of the Nile 7 cows, attractive and plump, and they fed in the reed grass. And behold, 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly, thin cows ate up the 7 attractive, plump cows, and Pharaoh awoke. Then he fell asleep, and he dreamed a second time, and behold, 7 ears of grain, plump and good, were growing on 1 stalk. And behold, after them sprouted 7 ears, thin and blighted by the east wind. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump, full ears. And Pharaoh woke, and behold, it was a dream. So in the morning his spirit was troubled. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, "I remember my offenses today. When Pharaoh was angry with his servant and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, we dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted it to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged." Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. When he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I've had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." And Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Behold, in my dream I was standing on the banks of the Nile. 7 cows, plump and attractive, came up out of the Nile and fed in the reed grass. 7 other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and thin, such as I had never seen in all the land of Egypt. And the thin, ugly cows ate up the 7 plump cows, but when they had eaten them, no one would have known that they had eaten them, for they were all still as ugly as at the beginning. And then I awoke. I also saw in my dream 7 ears growing on 1 stalk, full and good. 7 ears withered, thin and blighted by the east wind, sprouted after them, and the thin ears swallowed up the 7 good ears. And I told it to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me." Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one. The 7 lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the 7 empty ears blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them there will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine that will follow, for it will be very severe. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and a wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities. And let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine. This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this, in whom is the Spirit of God?" And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all of this, there is none so discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him ride in his second chariot, and they called out before him, "Bow the knee." Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. During the 7 plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly, and he gathered up all the food of those 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt and put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields around it. And Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. Before the year of famine came, 2 sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, "God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house." And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph. What he says to you, do." So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened up the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. Thus far the reading of God's holy word. Well, in my estimation, perhaps the most common question that any Christian asks is why? Why? Why, God? Why are you letting this happen to me? Why are you making me go through this? Why can't I get a job? Why do I have to have this job? Why can't I get a spouse? Why do I have to have this spouse? Why do things seem to be so difficult for me? Why is money so tight? Why is my health so poor? Why? To have a penny for every time a saint asked the Lord, why? Joseph certainly would have good reason to be asking why. Why is this his lot in life? What is the Lord trying to do with him? He thought he was meant to be king over his brothers. But instead, he now has endured for years slavery and then imprisonment at the hands of his brothers who betrayed him, Potiphar's wife who framed him, Potiphar who unjustly condemned him, and then that chief cupbearer who so callously forgot him. Why was the Lord allowing all this to happen? And we want to know the same thing as we read the story. What is going on? Why is all of this going on? What is the Lord doing here? What is the point of Joseph's story? Well, the answer begins to come into some clarity with this chapter. In this chapter, Joseph is finally raised up from the pit. He finally makes that transition from prisoner to prime minister. And what we're going to see as his suffering ends is that the Lord allowed Joseph to suffer. He allowed him to suffer so that others Indeed, entire nations, as we just read at the end of the chapter, indeed, entire nations could be spared. Joseph suffers so that others would be saved. He suffers in the pit, in prison, so that according to God's mysterious providence, at just the right time, he might be released in order to save a needy people. Well, we want to consider these things first by looking at the way that Joseph progresses in this story. The way that Joseph progresses. The way, meaning the manner in which he progresses, both in his career but also spiritually. Things are certainly looking up for Joseph. As I said, he becomes prime minister after all. And since we know that, because we are very familiar with the story of Joseph, it can be hard as we open up this chapter, chapter 41, and the very beginning says, after 2 whole years, and we just kind of glance right over that and keep on reading. But that would be to do a disservice to what the story is trying to teach us. Joseph's progress, his way forward, is not without its many, many steps backward. Joseph only knows success because he first knows suffering. You might say, yes, Jonathan, we've heard you say this before. We get it, Joseph suffers, right? You've been talking a lot about that in the story of Joseph. Yes, I have, but maybe that's because it's an important point to make. It's certainly an important point to make about the Christian life. Not just Joseph's life, but the Christian life. It's a principle that suffering will precede success. It's such an important principle that nearly every New Testament author mentions it in some fashion or another. Just for example, how about Paul in Romans chapter 5? We rejoice in our sufferings or our setbacks, knowing that our suffering produces endurance, and endurance character, and character hope, and hope does not put us to shame. Or James says almost the same words, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness take its full effect, that you might be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. The suffering, the trials, the setbacks lead to our perfection, our being perfected in Jesus Christ, our sanctification. But it's tough, isn't it? In the case of Joseph, we're confronted with the way of God's timing and how mysterious it is. We're confronted with how odd God seems to be working in this situation. For instance, Joseph is in prison for years. He languishes for years. But then look at verse 14. It takes just a matter of moments for all of that to be reversed. Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. That's Joseph's way forward. He's in prison for years, but then one night Pharaoh can't sleep, and he has this dream, and he tells the cupbearer. The cupbearer remembers Joseph. They say, go get him. Potiphar goes and gets him, says, clean up, you're about to meet the king. And within a matter of moments, he's prime minister. He's second in command. And perhaps if we were in Joseph's situation, we might be enraged. All of that suffering, Lord, and this is all it took to get me out of it. This is all you had to do was this one little thing, remind the cupbearer that I'm in here, and it would just take a matter of minutes for me to be out of prison. Why didn't you do it sooner if it was that easy? We might be tempted to be angry at God for his ways and for his timing. I remember one time, shortly after we were married, maybe we were married a year, Carrie and I went out on a date in back home in central Pennsylvania, which is sometimes affectionately referred to as Pennsyltucky. And we were going to a restaurant that wasn't in my hometown in Hollidaysburg, but in a couple towns over that was very small, farm town, dairy farmers. So imagine, you know, you're going from Kalamazoo to somewhere like Hopkins or Martin or something like that. Very small town, but it had one restaurant, and everybody said, you got to go there. Well, it'd been years since I'd lived back at home, and this wasn't even in my hometown, but we went to the restaurant, and I said to Carrie Ann, I'm sure I remember there's this delicious ice cream shop just around the corner near this restaurant. I've been here once or twice. I can find it. Well, let's look it up in the map. No, I can find it. And so we get in the car, and we're driving for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, you know, in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. And finally, I say, okay, you can pull up the GPS. But of course, because we're in Pennsylvania, there's no service. And it takes another 20 minutes before we finally find the ice cream shop. And we get our dessert, and we're sitting outside, lovely summer evening, sitting on the bench, enjoying our ice cream cones. And Carrie kind of tilts her head, and she looks behind the ice cream shop, and she says, isn't that the restaurant we were just at? And indeed it was. There was just a field maybe like 50 yards separating them. We could have walked to it. It would have taken 2 minutes. But instead we drove in circles in the middle of nowhere for 40 minutes. And sometimes we can feel like God is making us do that in life, right? He makes us languish and he makes us suffer when it would be so simple for him to just point us in the right direction and to save us. And so we could grow bitter. But Joseph, he does not grow bitter. That's not how he feels. And why is that? Well, yes, we must recognize that this way forward involved much suffering, many roadblocks along the way, and that it took practically nothing to finally vindicate him. But here's the thing you need to understand. When God gets you to where he wants you, when God gets you where he wants you, every trial and tribulation, every wrong turn, all that time he took to do it will seem like nothing other than blessing. One Puritan has famously said that God's providence is best read backwards. You can only understand it looking backwards. But once you arrive, everything that it took to get you there will seem like nothing other than blessing. Doesn't Paul talk about that in Romans 8 when he says that I consider the sufferings of this present age aren't even worth comparing to the glory that God has prepared to reveal to us? The steps back are nothing compared to the forward progress that we will inevitably receive by the Spirit's power. And when we get there, we will understand this, as Joseph does in Chapter 41. Maybe you're not there yet. Maybe you're still driving around in circles. Maybe you feel lost. Maybe you still feel like you're right in the midst of your suffering, of the darkness, and you feel like you're deep in the pit. Well, let me tell you, friends, it will not be for forever. And once you are out of it, you'll be able to look back and you'll understand it's all part of God's very good plan for you. One hymn writer illustrates it like this. He says that the road to heaven is sorely marked with earthly grief and pain. For here trials and tragedy are parked to block my upward gain. Doesn't it feel like that sometimes? Right? The things we go through in life are keeping us from heaven. Right? Trials and tragedies are parked to block my upward gain. He goes on to say, but know, the Savior says to me, each trouble here is given from my own hand, and it serves to be a higher step towards heaven. What seems like roadblocks are really steps to get you closer to heaven. Steps to get you closer to glory. Steps to get you further along in your sanctification. And the way forward for Joseph was so glorious that it was as if he never had to look back and remember his past suffering again. Isn't that what he commemorates in the naming of his children? If you look at verse 51, Joseph called the name of his firstborn son Manasseh. He named him Manasseh, for God has made me forget all of my hardships. And then he names his second son Ephraim. Why? Because God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Dear believing friends, can you not wait for that day when God will cause you to forget all your past hardships, all your past sin, all your past suffering, all your past heartache? Can you not wait for that moment when your mind and your memory will be filled with and only with all the good things that God has done for you? Can you not wait for that moment when we will realize without doubting that even in our affliction, God has made us fruitful? Because it's in our affliction, it's in our suffering that we receive endurance and character and hope, and hope does not put us to shame. It's in our setbacks that we will find steadfastness, and let it take its full effect that you might be perfect, perfectly complete in the work of God. We've seen that the way that Joseph progresses in this story, by God's inexplicable providence, included many setbacks and trouble. But also by God's inexplicable grace, it ended up in his being blessed in profound ways. So at first we were looking more at the divine work behind the scenes, we could say. We need to recognize that God always works through ordinary human agents, right? So the actual cause for Joseph being brought out of the pit is that Pharaoh needed someone to interpret his dreams. Pharaoh is in search of answers, and Joseph was the solution. So we want to see, secondly, the truth that Joseph possessed. The truth that he possessed, that he had. We've seen the way that he progresses, now the truth that he possesses. And the opening verses of the chapter describe for us the dreams that Pharaoh has. They are alike in nature. The first is a very Egyptian dream in flavor. There's these seven cows that are coming up out of the Nile. Cattle would often wade deep in the water to escape the heat, the Egyptian heat. And after them, after these fat, plump, healthy-looking cows come up, seven unhealthy, skinny cows come up, and they devour the fat cows, but nobody would know it. They don't look any bigger for it. And the second dream is very similar, this time though, with seven sickly-looking ears of grain devouring seven ripe and healthy-looking ears of grain. Now we know God does not speak to us today through dreams. He speaks to us in his word, but back then it pleased God to use dreams to advance his purpose. And so first, he gives Pharaoh this dream, these dreams that trouble him. But then second, he blanks the mind of all Pharaoh's wise men, all of his philosophers, all of his magicians, so that nobody can make heads or tails of it. Now, they had books on how to interpret dreams. Some of them are still in the museum at Cairo. But no books on mysticism were going to help them because they needed spiritual insight. And Pharaoh's really upset that nobody can figure this out. And so word reaches the cupbearer, and that makes sense because the cupbearer's position made him one who would be very close in proximity to Pharaoh. And he, when he finds out that Pharaoh's had this dream, remembers, it says, he remembers my past offense in verse 12. I remember my offenses, or verse 9. And then he proceeds to tell Pharaoh of this Hebrew. Verse 12, a young Hebrew was there. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us. And so do you see how God's providence masked in all of these mere coincidences is leading to Joseph's rescue and his restoration? So Joseph is brought before the king, and Pharaoh says, I hear you're really good at interpreting dreams. Can you give me an interpretation? What's Joseph's response? You see it there in verse 16. He answers Pharaoh, it's not in me, it's God. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So I want you to notice a couple things that are going on here. First, Pharaoh is desperate for answers, but he's not just desperate for any answers. He wants the right answers. He wants the real answers. He's not a relativist like you find today. In that case, he would say no interpretation matters, or all interpretations are equally valid. He wants the right one. Pharaoh is desperate for truth. That's the first thing to notice. But then secondly, his desperation for truth, his desire for truth is so great that he is willing to go to whatever lengths necessary to procure and discover it. Now keep this in mind. Pharaoh is considered semi-divine. He's considered to be a son of the gods. Yet even this son of the gods can't come up with the answer, nor can any of his magicians. And so Pharaoh will go to the lengths of stooping to speak to a mere Hebrew for help. Remember with what disdain Potiphar's wife spoke of Joseph? She said, our husband, he's mocking us by bringing a Hebrew in to run the house. Here we have the opposite. Pharaoh's desire for truth humbles him to accept it from whatever source. I wonder if you've ever had that search for truth before in your life. Have you ever had that burning desire for answers? And I don't mean for some simple trivia that you can pull out your smartphone and Google in 5 seconds. But a burning desire for the answers, for the answers to the big questions of life. Where did we come from? Is there a God? What is life all about? Why am I here? What happens after I die? Maybe you're on the search for those answers right now, here today. And let me make your search a little easier for you, friends. You need to seek out a man of God, just as Pharaoh does. And why is that? It's because the man of God or the woman of God will point you not to their own ideas, not to their own conclusions, not to their own truth, but to the truth of God himself. That's the third thing that we learn here, right? Pharaoh's desperate for answers. He wants truth. He goes to whatever lengths necessary to get that truth. And thirdly, we see that truth comes from God and God alone. That's what Joseph says. It's not in me. It's not from me. It's from God. Joseph possesses the truth that Pharaoh wants because Joseph, first and foremost, possesses the God of truth. Do you possess that God? Do you know that God? Now, truth is part of his makeup. It's who he is. It's part of his essence. Just as our DNA is what makes us up, so truth makes up who God is. Numbers 23, verse 19. God is not man that he should lie, or the son of man that he should change his mind. Or we read in Titus 1:2, it talks about the God who never lies. Or Isaiah 65 speaks of the God of truth. Louis Berkhof, the systematic theologian from Calvin Seminary, defines the attribute of God's truthfulness, or veracity, as it's called in theology, as that reality in which, quote, God is able to see things as they really are. Ergo, if we want to see things how they really are, we first need to see and to know and to possess this God of truth. Friends, any search for truth that is not a search for God is futile. But Pharaoh's search is not in vain. It's not in vain because he has Joseph, a truthful servant of a truthful God. His testimony points to the God of truth. And we, as children and servants of God, are to do the same thing. We are to be people of truth. We're to be people of our word because we belong to a God of truth, a God of his word. And his word is truth. Remember, Jesus says that in John 17, the high priestly prayer. He's praying to the Lord for his disciples. He says, this is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom you have sent. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. So you want to know the answers to the big questions in life, then you need to go to God. You need to go to his reliable and faithful and truthful word. That is what Pharaoh does. He seeks truth, he finds it, and he submits to it. What is the truth? Well, the truth is that Egypt is about to experience, after 7 years of plenty, they're going to have 7 years of famine. It's going to be really difficult. Remember that the two dreams are one. Their duplication is a way of driving home the point, Joseph says in verse 32. But while this seems like terrible news for Pharaoh and for his country, he's not that concerned because now he has this Joseph, this Hebrew, a man who's so clearly endowed with the wisdom of God that maybe, just maybe, he'll have an answer for how to get them out of this predicament. And indeed he does. And so you notice that even in the face of impending death and disaster for Egypt, we notice, thirdly and finally, the life that Joseph provides. We've seen the way that he progresses in this story. We've seen the truth that he holds on to, the truth that he possesses, and finally, the life that he provides for Egypt. Joseph gives his plan. It's going to be a 20% tax hike during the seven plentiful years in order to store up for those years of famine. And Pharaoh loves this idea so much, he says, why don't you just be my right-hand man? You be second in command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you, he says in verse 40. So Joseph is exalted. This is the fulfillment of that dream that started this whole thing when he says to his brothers, you're going to bow down to me one day. Well, here it is. And we also have the answer to our earlier question of why. Why was this happening to Joseph? And the answer quite simply is, it was in order to save the Egyptians. He suffered under the cruelty of his brothers and Potiphar for years, and it all escalated to this one moment, this one night when Pharaoh can't shake his dreams, and the morning when the cupbearer remembers Joseph, it all's leading up to this. His suffering was for the purpose of saving others. If he was never betrayed by his family, if he was never sold into slavery, if he was never put into prison, then Pharaoh would have had that dream and nobody would have been able to interpret it, and Egypt would not have been prepared for the famine that was to come, and they would have perished. But Joseph provides life for them. Of course, he provides life not only to Egypt, but to the whole world. You see that the very last verse, chapter 41, 57. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt, to Joseph, to buy grain. Joseph is the one who gives life to the whole world. But then even more importantly than that, it's not just Egypt, it's not just all these other nations, but specifically it will be the people of God, the Israelites. If you flip over just a few pages to chapter 45, you see Joseph explain this. He's finally encountering his brothers and he's explained who he is. And in chapter 45, verse 7, Joseph says what it's all about. He gives the answer to that question, why, when he says, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth. I came to save your life, he's saying. I came to preserve a remnant for you on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So that Israel, the people of God, when they had no bread, they would be able to come down to Egypt. And because of Joseph, they would be saved. Because of his actions, because of the mysterious work of God's providence, because of his mysterious way out of prison, because of the truth that he possesses, he can give them life. And the people of God are spared. And we know, though, ultimately, don't we, friends, that the salvation of the world, salvation of all the nations, the salvation of the people of God ultimately does not come from Joseph. It comes from Jesus. A Jesus who is the way to God. Jesus who holds the truth of God. And Jesus who gives life, everlasting life, that we might live before God forever. It's Jesus who suffered to spare others. His life of suffering was preparing for him a moment, mysteriously in God's providence, but a moment when the timing is just right, that he would be able to step in and save and spare others, that he would be able to step in and spare you and me. He suffers unimaginable torment in order to bring us indescribable life. It is Jesus Christ who ensures that as we endure the famine of the soul, the famine of a fallen world, that we would have bread. That's what he talks about in John 6. It's a famous passage, right? Jesus in John 6 says, I am the bread of life. And he explains it. He says, this is the bread that comes down from heaven so that one may eat of it and not die. I am that living bread that comes down from heaven. And if anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. Joseph couldn't say that, could he? He would have to say, the bread that I give for the life of the world is the bread that I've been storing up for 7 years, but eventually you're going to eat it. You're still going to grow hungry again. You're going to die eventually. Jesus says, the bread that I give for the life of the world is my flesh. He says, it's not like the bread that your fathers ate in the wilderness. You know, the manna from heaven. It's not like that bread. But we could add to that, it's not like the bread that your fathers ate in Egypt that Joseph had stored up. So they all still died. But he says, this bread is different. And whoever feeds on it will live forever. At the close of this entire ordeal, Joseph was able to look back and say that the Lord had made him fruitful in the land of his affliction. He was able to look back through all of his suffering and say that this was for a purpose, and God has made me fruitful. And we will be able to say the same thing, that God has made us fruitful in the land of our affliction. But it's hard to know that when you are in the affliction, when you are in the suffering, right here and right now, as we said, providence is best read backwards. So here's what you need to know while you're in the midst of affliction, while you're in the midst of your suffering. You need to hear this beautiful promise from God. Yes, he promises to make you fruitful, and one day you will see that. But even in the midst of your affliction, he promises to care for you, to provide for you. And he does that through Jesus Christ. He's promised to watch over you in the desert wilderness. He's promised to feed you in your time of famine, all through his Son. The bread of life, the bread of heaven. Brothers and sisters, will you accept this gracious provision from God? Will you feed on this provision? Will you make Christ first in your life? Will you make him your only portion? And will you make him your strongest desire? Will you make him your all in all? Because here's the promise. If you come to Christ in that kind of way, you will drink and you will never thirst again. And if you feed on him, you will live forever. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that you are indeed a gracious God, that you even use our suffering and our affliction for our benefit, to make us fruitful, to produce in us character that is pleasing in your sight. When we are in the midst of the darkness, when we are deep down in the pit, it can be hard to believe that. But Lord, would we take hold by faith your promise to us that you will care for us, and you have provided abundantly for us in Jesus Christ. Give us this bread from heaven and feed us, Lord, till we want no more. We ask this for Christ's sake. Amen.